Hi, this is Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
We had a great reputation in Iran up till 1953. After that, we had proven that we were willing to go into a foreign country and overthrow their prime minister. How would we feel if somebody did that to us?
We cannot link any casualties the way that, we had Admiral Mullen saying there's blood on his hands, and that's just simply not the case.
You're listening to the podcast of the August 22nd, 2013 edition of Tell Somebody. The second segment of the show is about Chelsea Manning and was recorded Wednesday evening, August 21st, 2013. The following morning, shortly before the KKFI broadcast, the Army private and WikiLeaks whistleblower, formerly known as Bradley Manning, announced in a statement via lawyer David Coombs the decision to transition to life as a woman and a request to be referred to as Chelsea and with female pronouns. Hello and welcome to Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop us a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. The podcast of last week's edition of Tell Somebody with Moji Agha speaking about his Mossadegh Awareness Tour has been posted. Go to tellsomebody.us and click on the tile with the picture of Mohammed Mossadegh at the Liberty Bell for links to listen to this show or download an MP3 to your computer. You can also subscribe to the Tell Somebody podcast for free at the iTunes Store. Before moving on to other events in Colorado and elsewhere, Moji Agha spoke in Independence last Sunday about the movement he is hoping to start and about the CIA coup that overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. On Monday, marking the 60th anniversary of the overthrow of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, the National Security Archive posted recently declassified CIA documents on the United States' role in the controversial operation, American and British involvement in Mossadegh's ouster has long been public knowledge, but Monday's posting included what is believed to be the CIA's first formal acknowledgement that the agency helped to plan and execute the coup. To find out more about the National Security Archive and this latest release, I contacted Malcolm Byrne, National Security Archive Deputy Director and Director of Research. Byrne has worked at the archive since 1986 and since 1990 has supervised the research process of identifying and obtaining documentation for the archive's collections. He currently directs the Openness in Russia and Eastern Europe Project and the U.S.-Iranian Relations Project, both of which promote multinational and multi-archival approaches to the study of recent controversial historical events. Previously, he served as co-director of the Iran-Contra Documentation Project and coordinated the archives project on U.S.-Soviet relations during the Cold War. Malcolm Byrne, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you very much.
Before we get started on the CIA release that you just announced, can you very briefly tell us what is the National Security Archive?
Sure. It sounds like a spy agency, but it's as close to the opposite as you probably could get. We are a non-governmental, non-profit organization. We're based at George Washington University, and our mission since about 1985 has been to try to break loose historically important documents on the history of U.S. foreign policy. And we use the Freedom of Information Act to do that for the most part. And we use that to the full extent possible, which means sometimes going to court, taking the CIA to court, as we have done in this case in connection with the Iran coup materials, and just try to press for more rational secrecy and declassification policies so that there's a better shot at having transparent government and some accountability in Washington.
Okay, and on the 60th anniversary, I believe, of the 1953 coup in Iran, the National Security Archive announced CIA confirms role in 1953 Iran coup. Documents provide new details on Mossadegh overthrow and its aftermath. Now, people who have paid any attention at all have known for quite some time that this has happened. I believe Kermit Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, wrote some memoirs about his participation in it.
Right.
What's the big deal now of the CIA admitting something everybody knew they did?
You know, that's just the right way to put it. What's the big deal? Because in terms of the details of it, you know, it's not telling us anything we don't know, like you said. We've known since, you know, at least 1954 when the Saturday Evening Post, if your listeners remember that old magazine, published a detailed account of the coup, and they could only have gotten that from CIA sources. Ever since then, the agency has been playing a kind of cat and mouse game where they will, you know, let information go out into the public domain through leaks or what have you, but they will not give their official say-so about whether they were involved. And this is a standard kind of thing. And, you know, if I'm going to defend them for a second, this is what intelligence agencies do, right? They don't divulge information. They keep it secret. They hold on to it because they see it as very important to their mission. They don't want anybody to know how they do their job, what they're thinking about, all that kind of stuff. And it's those sorts of reasons that they will give you for why they hold on to this information. So to me, the big deal is that they have changed their mind on this, at least, you know, by inference, by allowing this information to come out in a declassified version of a once secret document. That for those of us who look into these kinds of issues and try to get our government to open up more, that's great. That's a good thing.
And were there any surprises in the release that you saw?
Well, the release was about maybe 200 pages total. So that one document that had those key couple of sentences was just one of the items. For me, because I've looked at this for a long time, I found more of interest in some of the files that Kermit Roosevelt kept. And you mentioned him, and he was a key figure in the coup, and he did write a book about it afterwards. But at the time of the coup, he was in Tehran, in Iran, and he was, you know, trying to put this thing together. It was a much more complicated and hectic process than subsequent accounts have portrayed it. And some of those accounts are written by the people who put it together. So no big surprise that they would try to write about it in a way that, you know, made them look pretty good. But when you look at these day-to-day files and reports that Roosevelt was sending back to Washington and to who knows where else, it's like a little diary account, you know, of what was happening, who he was hearing about, who he was meeting with, what kinds of problems were coming up, you know, what member of Iran's parliament they had met with, and how they were going to try to get money to these guys, in other words, to bribe them. how they were working with military officers to try to organize networks of military folks who would go around and seize critical facilities at the right time. Even, you know, who in the among the clerics, the mullahs, were they hoping to work with or in contact with already to get them to generate big crowds in favor of the Shah when the time came. So really fascinating stuff in that sense.
I seem to remember reading someplace that Norman Schwarzkopf's father was also involved. Is that
right? That's true, because he was the guy who trained the Shah's gendarmes way back when. And he came into play in this story because the Shah was getting cold feet. And the Americans and the British, they kind of alternated. That sometimes, you know, American officials over the years have thought the Shah was really something and a great strategic thinker and all this kind of stuff. And at other times, like around this coup, when you read some of the records, it's pretty contemptuous of the guy. They think he's a coward. He vacillates, can't make up his mind. So they worked hard to try to convince him that he should go along with this plan. And part of the way that they did that was by sending in people who they thought could influence the Shah, like his sister and a couple of other folks. And one of them was Schwarzkopf, because the Shah trusted him. He had done good work for him and so on. And so Schwarzkopf went in and talked to him and helped to bring him around.
And I seem to remember reading in some other context some time ago that the actual coup in 1953 came during the Eisenhower administration, but wasn't President Truman also approached?
Yes.
And turned down the idea?
He did. In late 1952, around late November of 52, a couple of British operatives came to Washington to talk to the Truman people and to try to get them to sign on to this plan. Now, for 2 years prior to this, the British had been going nuts because Iran, under that prime minister, Mossadegh, had nationalized the oil industry and a year later kicked the British out. So you remember that after World War II, the British were in bad shape. Economically, they were struggling. They'd had a couple of bad winters. They were, they were still trying to get back up on their feet and still relying on their empire to bring in revenue. Well, the Abadan oil refinery in Iran was one of their most important economic entities in the world. And for Mossadegh to kick them out was what really got them angry about this whole thing. So they were ready to open fire, they were ready to send troops, they were ready to do all this kind of stuff, and Truman had to talk them down. He thought that the U.S. and the U.K. needed to negotiate with the Iranians. Well, right after the 52 elections, which brought in the Eisenhower people, the British came with this plan, and they, more or less said, well, you don't want us to invade, how about we do something a little quieter, but that could really do the trick? And to me, do you mind if I go on a little bit?
Oh, please, please do.
Okay. To me, it's an interesting what-if question, because the British clearly didn't get it, in a sense. I mean, you don't go to an administration that's on its way out, a lame duck administration, and propose something that's as big a deal as this. You know, they're as likely as not, or much more likely, in my view, going to say, no, we can't take something like this on. We're a month and a half away from the new president coming in. And this is exactly what they said. They said, go talk to the next guys. We're not in a position to do anything about it. And I believe at that point they weren't quite ready to do it. But what if the Democrats, the Truman people, had stayed in office? You can look back at some of the records that are out there now, and you can see a trend in their thinking, that things are getting worse and worse on the ground in Iran. Mossadegh is getting a little crazier. He's refusing to make any kind of concessions to the British. The situation's getting much more unstable. And what's that going to lead to? The Russians, the communists, are going to have an opening to take over. And that was the big fear. So what you see at the end of the Truman administration is some contingency planning taking shape where Truman actually was willing to consider sending in American troops to the country if the Soviets tried something first. And that, on one level, is even more than what Eisenhower did, because Eisenhower wasn't talking about sending the Marines. He wanted to do something quiet and low cost. Truman was ready to go all out, but the key difference was that he assumed that this would only happen if the Russians acted first, whereas Eisenhower was ready to preempt this whole potential crisis, and he wanted to go in before something happened. But what would have happened if Truman had stayed in and the situation had kept getting worse and worse? Maybe he would have done something similar.
Yeah, now, if I recall correctly, I think after he was out of office, Truman wrote an op-ed in the New York Times or someplace, expressing regret on setting up the CIA as a two-pronged organization. He wished
right.
he had just done the intelligence gathering
right.
Part of it.
That's a little like Eisenhower saying, "Watch out for the military-industrial complex." After he's, on his way out, it's an important point to make in both cases. But gee, couldn't you have said something sooner? Because Truman did set up that part of the CIA. He set up the whole CIA. He was the president under whom that agency came into existence, and he made use of it. He did a lot of things that were very closely held. He sent in emigre forces to the Ukraine, to Albania, airdropped these people in to try to infiltrate them in, and all of those operations blew up in the Americans' faces, and it really burned them. And this was why Truman felt really badly about it afterwards. And ironically, it was one of these things that Eisenhower used to get elected. He ran his campaign in part on, the notion of getting tough on the Russians. Well, to think that Truman was not tough on the Russians is ridiculous, given the record that we now have. But because he had pulled back on these ideas of doing covert operations, and because the Chinese Revolution had happened under his watch, the Korean War had started, the Eisenhower campaign was able to say, look, look at all this mess that's happened, and Truman isn't ready to do anything about it, but we are. So it was a great tactic, and it helped get him into office.
Okay, well, I know your time is short, but any final words on why Americans should be interested in this today, 60 years later, and anything else about how to find the National Security Archive?
Sure. Well, our website is www.nsarchive.org, so NS like National Security. And we're based at GW University. We've got a ton of materials that we've gotten through the same means, through the Freedom of Information Act, and we put them up regularly. And a lot of them are tied to today's events. So, if you see something about Iraq or, China or spying, the National Security Agency or things of that sort, then come to our site and take a look, because odds are you'll find some great stuff. Now, why should you care? Because these are issues, and this particular issue, the Iran coup, is something that still makes a lot of noise in Iran today. There are a lot of Americans wonder, what on earth did we do to make the Iranians hate us this way? Well, deservedly or not, the 53 coup was, in a sense, the start of it all. We had a great reputation in Iran up till 1953. After that, we had proven that we were willing to go into a foreign country and overthrow their prime minister. How would we feel if somebody did that to us? The Eisenhower people had their reasons for it. I happen to think they were misplaced, but at the end of the day, the history of this coup has become a weapon that the people in Iran, who really don't want anything to do with the United States, use against us all the time. They say, look at what they did to us in the past. They can't be trusted. So these issues still have meaning today. And beyond the coup itself, the whole notion of what the government keeps secret and doesn't keep secret is a very important issue. And all of us can agree or disagree on specific points, what things deserve to be kept classified and what don't. But the bottom line for me and for my organization is that we all have to keep a lookout and make sure that we're okay with the job the government's doing. And the best way to do that is to have as much access to the record as we can safely have.
And what if isn't always a precise science, but it's hard to imagine the 1979 ascent of the Shah and the hostages
absolutely.
Without this coup.
That's exactly right.
Okay, well, Malcolm Byrne with the National Security Archive, I really appreciate your time. Maybe we can talk to you again sometime.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Crazy Horse 1-8, Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Yeah, Bushmaster 7, Crazy Horse 1-8, location of bodies, Mike Bravo, 5458-8617.
Hey, good on the kitchen, that's good.
5458-8617, over.
It's Crazy Horse 1-8, that's a good copy. They're on a street in front of an open courtyard with a bunch of blue trucks, a bunch of vehicles in the courtyard.
There's one guy moving down there, but he's the one.
All right, we'll let him know so they can hurry up. Get over here.
It's 1-8. We also have one individual appears to be wounded, trying to crawl away.
Roger. We're going to move down there.
Roger. We'll cease fire.
And we won't shoot anymore.
If he has a weapon though in his hand?
No, I haven't seen one yet.
You guys got that guy crawling right now on the curb?
Yeah, I got him. I put two rounds in here, and you guys are shooting over there too, so we'll see.
Yeah, Roger.
Bushmaster 36 Element, this is Hotel 27, over.
Hotel 27, Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, I'm just trying to make sure that you guys have my turb, over.
Come on, buddy. My God, just pick up a weapon.
Crazy Horse, Bushmaster 5, or Bushmaster 4, break. Here, right below you, right time now. Can you walk us on to that location, over?
This is 2-6, Roger. I'll pop flares. We also have one individual moving. We're looking for weapons. If we see a weapon, we're going to engage. Now, Bushmaster, we have a van that's approaching and picking up the bodies.
Where's that van at?
Right down there by the body.
Okay, yeah.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse, we have individuals going to the scene. Looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
Hey, we need to stop that. We get down there. We need to stop. You see my location?
Roger. Break. Crazy Horse 1-8. Request permission to engage.
I'm picking up the wounded.
Yeah, we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
A Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
We're taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
It's Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV or a bongo truck picking up the bodies. Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on.
Clear. Clear.
Orange.
Coming around clear.
Roger. Trying to,
clear.
Roger, I lost him in the
dust. I got him.
I'm firing.
George, Bushmaster 4, you got any BDA on that truck? Over.
You're clear. This is, Crazy Horse, standby.
I'm shooting for some reason.
Go ahead.
I think the fan's disabled.
Go ahead and shoot it.
I got an azimuth limit for some reason.
What you just heard was an audio excerpt from the collateral murder video. If you have not seen it yet, you really should. And the video with Ethan McCord describing how he rescued two children whose father was slaughtered in the encounter you just heard. www.collateralmurder.org. Collateral Murder was perhaps the most famous part of what Bradley Manning released to WikiLeaks, but there was, of course, much, much more, including reading now parts of a post by Ryan Gallagher at Slate.com in June, that the U.S. Embassy in Paris advised Washington to start a military-style trade war against any European Union country that opposed genetically modified crops, with U.S. diplomats effectively working directly for GM companies such as Monsanto, that British and American officials colluded in a plan to mislead the British Parliament over a proposed ban on cluster bombs, that U.S. Special Operations Forces were conducting offensive operations inside Pakistan despite sustained public denials and statements to the contrary by U.S. officials, and that a leaked diplomatic cable provided evidence that during an incident in 2006, U.S. troops in Iraq executed at least 10 Iraqi civilians, including a woman in her 70s and a five-month-old, then called in an airstrike to destroy the evidence. The disclosure of this cable was later a significant factor in the Iraqi government's refusal to grant U.S. troops immunity from prosecution beyond 2011, which led to U.S. troops withdrawing. Bradley Manning was sentenced yesterday to 35 years in prison. As Wall Street executives who committed felony fraud resulting in millions of people losing their jobs and their homes go unpunished, as we look forward, not back, at war criminals and torturers who go unpunished, Bradley Manning was sentenced yesterday to 35 years in prison. There have been no official transcripts of the trial, but donations have supported unofficial transcripts by the Freedom of the Press Foundation. According to the transcript for yesterday's session, after some very brief procedural chit-chat, the judge, Colonel Denise Lind, said, PFC Bradley E. Manning, this court sentences you to be reduced to the grade of private E1, to forfeit all pay and allowances, to be confined for 35 years, and to be dishonorably discharged from the service. Please be seated. PFC Manning will be credited with 1,182 days of pretrial confinement and 112 days of Article 13 credit, for a total of 1,294 days of sentence credit. This court is adjourned. To talk about this, I once again contacted Nathan Fuller, campaign support, with the Bradley Manning Support Network. Fuller has attended all sessions of the Manning trial. Nathan Fuller is a New Jersey-based writer, editor, and activist. He studied documentary film and journalism at the College of New Jersey, where he edited a political news magazine. He was active in anti-war, LGBT, and social justice efforts for several years before becoming an avid supporter of Bradley Manning, as well as WikiLeaks. He believes the material Bradley is credited with releasing warrants all the support we can provide. Nathan creates and edits campaign materials and assists with national special events. I spoke with him last night. Give a listen. Nathan Fuller with the Bradley Manning Support Network. Welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Bradley Manning was sentenced this morning. I understand that was a pretty short session in the court. Is that right?
Yep, only a couple minutes there. And she just read the sentence and he was whisked away.
And 35 years, is that right?
35 years, yep, minus the 3.5 years for the time he's already served, and 112 days of that is for the abusive treatment he endured at the Quantico Marine Brig in solitary confinement.
So what was your reaction? I mean, given the incredibly harsh treatment he got in the first part of his 3 years of confinement before the trial, and the president declaring him guilty, and the zeal with which they seem to want to go after him, facing life in prison at some point, conceivably even the death penalty, in that light, 35 years looks pretty good. But for people...
Well, I suppose it could certainly be worse, but I think it's pretty devastating to jail a whistleblower for any time, let alone several decades. The government severely overreached by overcharging him with several Espionage Act convictions and the ridiculous aiding the enemy charge, and so they only look reasonable compared to their more extreme selves. They only look reasonable compared to the life sentence or the death penalty, but we shouldn't forget that this is somebody who exposed crimes, not who committed crimes. And the people that he exposed, those perpetrators of the killing of innocent civilians or who oversaw torture or who ignored torture, have not been prosecuted. It's Bradley Manning is the only one going to jail for those crimes.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think he should get a medal and no time. But can you talk a little bit about what was heard in the last couple of days in court before the sentencing, the arguments made by the prosecution and the defense for what they thought he should get?
Yeah, so the prosecution tried to show great harm that Bradley Manning caused and WikiLeaks caused to try to match up with the rhetoric that we heard since 2010, essentially. We've heard that WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning have blood on their hands, that they put soldiers at risk, and if led to the deaths of activists and sources and soldiers. But it came out in the government's case with the government's own witness saying that no deaths or casualties could be linked to the war logs or the diplomatic cables. Now they had to relocate some sources and people who are cooperative with the U.S. and who could face retribution, but we cannot link any casualties the way that, we had Admiral Mullen saying there's blood on his hands, and that's just simply not the case. So the defense in cross-examination elicited a lot of bad evidence to show that there was actually no real harm and more speculative harm, kind of the risk of harm. And that should have reduced the sentence a whole lot more, I think. And then in the defense's case, since Bradley was pleading to a military judge alone, not to a jury, to the military judge, we wanted to show the extenuating circumstances Manning was in. The defense showed evidence that Manning was under stress and then had psychological issues and was isolated by the Army because the Army was what military doctors called hyper-masculine and openly hostile environment. And while it's not directly related to his actions, of course, it's the kind of extenuating circumstances are the kind of thing that judges often get used for some leniency, but it does not necessarily appear to be the case here.
We're recording this on Wednesday, just in the afternoon of when he was sentenced in the morning. I understand there was a press conference. His main defense attorney, David Coombs, has chosen not to speak much throughout the trial, but did he speak at the press conference?
He did. He condemned the persecution of Bradley Manning, the Obama administration's widespread crackdown on leakers and therefore on journalism. He read a statement from Bradley Manning who said that sometimes you have to pay the heavy price to live in a free society. And he announced that he will be, while he won't be handling the appeals court process, he will be applying for clemency and then officially applying for a presidential pardon, calling on the Obama administration to pardon Bradley Manning or at least commute his sentence based on just the unjust nature of so much of it.
And do you have any sense of this? I mean, I would think most of us wouldn't have high realistic expectations of getting a pardon, but what's your thoughts on that?
Obama wouldn't pardon him on his own, certainly, but it's going to take some pressure, and so we're going to make that a serious campaign, is to show President Obama that Bradley Manning has widespread support, that he has international support. He's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 3 years in a row. He's given us a clear picture of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars and how the United States conducts diplomacy. We thank Bradley Manning, and we should do that publicly to put political pressure on the administration. And if he refuses to, it should be a 2016 presidential election issue that forces someone's hand.
And what is your sense? You've been to the entire trial and obviously followed this very closely, reporting for the Bradley Manning Support Network. Do you have a strong sense that things like the I Am Bradley Manning pictures on Facebook and protests big and small have really had an effect?
Well, it certainly had an effect on Bradley's prison conditions. He was in solitary confinement at Quantico Marine Brig for more than 9 months, and after international outrage and pressure and protests, he was moved to Fort Leavenworth in medium security and removed from solitary confinement. And David Coombs, his lawyer, has said on multiple occasions now that it's the pressure that we put on the military to do that. Wouldn't have done that on our own. And we can also have the effect of just raising awareness. We can keep people informed about the trial because it's not getting tons of mainstream attention in each little hearing, and so we can certainly have an effect that way.
And I've been getting a lot of information throughout from www.bradleymanning.org. I have a press release email of a new site being launched. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so that's our site, pardon.bradleymanning.org. That's kind of the updated to iambradleymanning.org, and that's where people, celebrities, but also supporters worldwide are going to post photos and reasons for supporting a pardon for Bradley Manning, and that's to show the administration that this has far-reaching political support.
Okay. Well, we've been talking to Nathan Fuller with the Bradley Manning Support Network. Any other thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners before you go?
That's the main thing. Check out our site, bradleymanning.org, and pardon.bradleymanning.org. Appreciate you having me on.
Okay, I appreciate you taking the time, and best of luck with it.
Thank you. Talk soon.
Nathan Fuller, www.bradleymanning.org, www.pardon.bradleymanning.org, and search Bradley Manning on Facebook. You should find a page for the local Bradley Manning support group. Manning will be returning to prison in Leavenworth.
Well, I think I'd love to hear about We Really Wish.
Your days of hoping and wishing are almost over. The Local Community Radio Act is now law, and community groups and nonprofits have the chance to apply for their very own community radio station. As soon as the summer of 2012, groups will have a one-time chance to apply. Visit PrometheusRadio.org/getradio to learn more.
There is a rapidly approaching deadline for low-power FM radio station applications, an opportunity to change the media landscape in a very big way that I fear may be squandered. This opportunity will not come again. In the time remaining, I'm going to replay part of an interview from March of 2012 with Brandy Doyle of Prometheus Radio, explaining what this is about. Brandy Doyle is the policy director with the Prometheus Radio Project. Brandy Doyle, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you so much, Tom.
We have had a little ripple of news about an FCC decision regarding low-power FM radio. We had you on the show last summer and, among other things, talked about the Local Community Radio Act that passed in January. And in a new book called Community Radio in the 21st Century, which is kind of a compilation of essays, you wrote that passage of this law created an opportunity for the largest expansion of community radio in U.S. history. Although it's too early to know how this opportunity will be realized, the expansion of low-power FM radio will change the face of U.S. community radio and perhaps the American media landscape in the 21st century. This sounds like a pretty big deal, and if we get time, we'll go back to some of the specifics of the legislation and FCC action recently. But I wonder if, for people who have not followed this at all, could you explain what LPFM is and why this is a historic opportunity?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Well, LPFM stands for Low Power FM Radio, and it was created by the FCC in the year 2000 to address the need for local community voices on the airwaves at a time of really intense consolidation in broadcast media ownership. You know, since the late 90s and the Telecom Act in 1996, our commercial radio landscape has really transformed and become more and more consolidated, with fewer and fewer networks owning more stations all over the country. And what that's meant for most places is that there isn't a local community radio station or local radio station of any kind that plays news, that has local information, that can do emergency response in that area. And the radio has become, you know, wasteland of repeated playlists and the same talk radio hosts over and over again around the country. And even the FCC recognized that this was a problem, and so they created LPFM Radio to give community groups an alternative, and they did it in response to incredible grassroots pressure from folks all over the country, some of whom were building their own radio stations without a license at all, and the FCC finally made a license available that was specifically for small community groups, for nonprofit organizations, that would make it affordable for regular folks to get on the air and for community organizations who maybe have another mission in their community. Maybe it's a church, maybe it's an environmental group that wants to be able to better organize and spread their information and get people involved. Maybe a school, maybe a neighborhood association that works on a number of different things. So, you know, they wanted to make a radio service that was affordable for regular folks to be able to use their own local airwaves. And so that's when LPFM radio got started. But unfortunately, almost as soon as the FCC introduced it, the commercial broadcast lobby acted to limit it. They were scared of the competition. They didn't want to have local community groups on the airwaves, and they pushed a law through Congress that kept low-power radio in rural and suburban areas And so the FCC hasn't really made any opportunities available for more than 12 years now, because there was no way for them to do it in populated areas, and they didn't think it was worth the trouble. So for the past 12 years, Prometheus, the organization I work with, and many other groups around the country have fought to pass a law in Congress to repeal the law the broadcasters pushed for back in 2000, and to expand community radio to all of our cities and towns. And just over a year ago, we won. We passed the Local Community Radio Act. It was signed into law by the president in January of 2011. And the law repeals this earlier law the broadcasters passed, which had limited community radio. And it directs the FCC to expand opportunities all over the country. So we're in a place now where we expect that community groups nationwide will be able to apply for these new low-power community radio stations as early as probably this winter, the end of this year.
And just briefly, also in this book, Community Radio in the 21st Century, you said the National Association of Broadcasters, the lobbying group of commercial broadcasters, but also National Public Radio lobbied against this new service, correct?
That's right. That's right. It's unfortunate, but you know, incumbent broadcasters of all sorts had lobbied hard against the expansion of community radio and getting new voices on the air.
So, as you said, kind of a bottom-up grassroots pressure led by your organization, Prometheus Radio Project, was successful. If let's try to talk about, say, a local Occupy group or some group of activists. This hasn't been on their radar. They're trying to get the word out about their issues, but they don't know much about LPFM. They can wait a couple of years and just get to this later, right?
That's a great question. Actually, no. This is a one-time-only opportunity. You know, the FM dial is pretty close to full right now. There's a lot of stations already out there, and so we expect that when the FCC takes applications for new radio stations this time around, it may be the last opportunity ever to get on the FM dial with a community radio station. So they don't take applications any day of the week. They'll have a particular deadline, particular time you can apply. It's called a window. And we don't know yet when that window will be scheduled, but we know it's coming probably by the end of this year. And groups who are interested in thinking about this should go ahead and start preparing now, because by the time the window comes, they usually open it for just a couple of days. So you want to basically have your application all set before that. And, you know, it's been 12 years since the last window, so we don't expect, you know, if there is ever another one, it's not coming anytime soon. And we don't think there's going to be many spots left available on the dial. So, you know, I would encourage any community group out there who's thinking about this to go ahead and you could log on to our website, PrometheusRadio.org, and click on I Want to Start a Station, and then you can sign up with us for updates from the FCC and training opportunities and information that we'll send out to folks about the process. You know, the application isn't online yet, so we can't send you that, but you know, if you get on our mailing list, we can send it to you when it's there.
And tell us that website one more time.
Sure. It's Prometheus, and that's Prometheus, radio.org.
And, again, let's talk about why this is a big deal. As you said, this will probably never come again as an opportunity to get on the FM radio dial. And what is it, possibly over 1,000 stations nationwide?
I think there could be many, many more than that. It all depends on the demand. Right now, you know, depending on where you're at, there are going to be frequencies available all over the country. And, you know, it's up to us to seize this opportunity. So if people applied for every single frequency out there, I think there could be thousands and thousands. So we're really hoping to spread the word and get the word out to folks that, you know, now this is coming, now's the time to get ready, because, you know, the character of this, you know, that quote you read that I heard said, you know, this could change the FM dial, but we don't know how yet. I mean, that's really true. We don't, you know, the character of this new low power radio service, whether it's a really helpful, whether it really changes communities, is going to depend on who applies for these licenses. And so, you know, if a real local group that's interested in serving their community and has, you know, has a mission that's going to use that radio station to enrich and enliven and inspire their community, that, you know, that could change that whole town. But it's really up to us to make sure that these channels are applied for. So, you know, we encourage you, if you're out there listening and you're not sure if you want to start a station, but you know a community group who would be great for this, let them know. You know, many people haven't heard about this opportunity yet.
And each station is kind of hyper-local. What is it, like typically something like 3 to 10 mile radius of broadcast
signal? That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep, and so they're great for, you know, if you have a particular community in a geographic area, neighborhood, a city, you know, section of the city, they're great for that. They're depending on the terrain, yeah, I think 3 to 10 miles is about right.
But with possibly thousands of such stations, even though each one is hyper-local, this could have a huge impact nationally, couldn't it?
That's right. You know, and I think it's hard to imagine what it would look like if we each had our each neighborhood had our own local media that was really community controlled, because it's so different from the landscape we have now. And your listeners have a sense of what it's like to have a community radio station, but not every town is so lucky. You know, that it's, I think it's hard for folks to imagine what it would be like for every community to really have their own local media where you can hear your neighbor's voices, you can get involved in local debates about local issues. I think it transforms local politics. I think it transforms local music scenes and where we have them. You know, and right now there's about 800 low-power stations on the air, though not all of them are community-oriented, though many are. And so we're hoping that with this next opportunity that we can build more of these great, you know, participatory stations that bring in the participation of the community.
Yes, and KKFI is a 100,000-watt full-power FM community radio station, which is kind of rare in community radio. And the good news is we have a broadcast range of something approaching 2 million pairs of ears, but there's so many local communities within that range that try as we might, we can't cover all the super local issues these people are concerned about.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I used to work with WMNF, which is a 70,000 watt full power community station in Tampa, Florida. And during my time there, I lived in Sarasota, which is about an hour's drive from the station. WSLR, which is a low-power station, started up in my town in Sarasota, and it's kind of amazing to have both. You know, it's amazing, like I have had the benefit of having the fantastic programming that came from a station that had been there for 30 years, and then WSLR did an amazing job of connecting Sarasota, which is, you know, a different place than Tampa. It's an hour's drive away with different community there, and so I think that, you know, there's room for a lot of good media.
Yeah, so Brandy Doyle, Policy Director with Prometheus Radio Project. I know you have to go very shortly, but just any final thoughts you want to leave with our listeners before you do?
Well, I'd just say if you're interested in this opportunity, you should go on our website, get involved, or if you know a local group that you think would be a great steward of the airwaves in your town, let them know. And, you know, this is an opportunity, but the FCC can't change the media for us. You know, this FCC decision that's been the first step in implementing the Local Community Radio Act is a great step forward, but most of the steps we're going to have to take ourselves. So I encourage folks to get involved.
Okay. Well, Brandy Doyle, thank you very much for talking to us again on Tell Somebody.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.